Welcome to Lickin' On Leadership.
Good to have you joining me on the Lickin' On Leadership podcast.
Podcast for leaders in the mortgage industry.
Well, this is about leadership, and you are certainly one of the leaders in the industry.
Here's your host of Lickin' On Leadership, David Lickin.
Folks, I'm excited to introduce to you a new friend of mine, Faith Schwartz. She's the owner of Housing Finance System Strategies, and she also consults to companies like Form Free. Faith, good to have you joining me on the Lickin' On Leadership podcast. Really appreciate you being here.
Well, thanks, David. I appreciate you inviting me.
Well, this is about leadership, and you are certainly one of the leaders in the industry. So it is a real honor and blessing to have you and talk about this, my favorite topic, leadership. But let's start with how long you've been in the industry, how you got into it, and some of that, some of the insights in your background. Let our audience know about that.
Sure. You know, I now say I've been in the industry, it's amazing to say, over 30 years. I entered the housing industry and mortgage industry right out of graduate school, where I got an MBA in finance and was fresh on the tracks moving to Washington, D.C. to find a job. So right out of business school, I joined a company called Dominion Bank Shares Mortgage Corporation, the old Dominion Bank subsidiary out of Roanoke. And it was my first job, and I have been in housing ever since and had a fantastic ride at Dominion Bank Shares.
Oh, that's awesome. And then from Dominion, kind of walk us through to where you're at today. This is for those that are new to the industry. They're interested in how did certain leaders get to where they're at and the place of influence in your case.
Yeah, well, and I'd be doing it short shrift if I didn't pay Dominion a big homage to my background in leadership, because I was there for 10 years, which is, in these days, a long time in any company in mortgage. But I learned the business of securitization and wholesale lending and even technology while I was at Dominion Bank Shares and had fantastic leaders there. One of my customers after 10 years where I purchased mortgages from was starting a new company and asked me to come help him lead it as the limited partner and COO. And that was Kevin Ryan at TMC Mortgage. And after that, I spent about 4 years. We merged our company. We were successfully managed and grew a very good institution, a regional presence. And then I moved on to Fieldstone, and then I moved on to Freddie Mac, and then I moved on to Option One, and then I ran the Hope Now Alliance through the crisis. So I had a very strong foundation. And I think one thing that developed was my appreciation for housing policy in Washington as it affects the business, become kind of more expert in both of those areas.
You are definitely a housing policy expert, but what drew you to that? Was there a story that's behind that? Did you see some inequities or some things that need to get fixed, or is it just how you're wired?
Well, you know, it's a little of both. I actually think, and it's later on as we speak to maybe the final leadership qualities, I think it's very important to be both internal and external in any company. And
we should probably have you expand on that. What do you mean by both external and internal?
Learning the business internally is very important, and it's foundational, and that's what I did at Dominion Bank Shares. But even at Dominion, I raised my hand to join committees and join organizations such as the MBA. And later on in my career at Freddie Mac, I joined Women in Housing Finance in Washington, D.C., where I later on became the president of that, you know, nonprofit organization as a side job. But I think understanding the impacts to your business, the externalities, the forces that help change, maybe it's a regulatory change, maybe it's an OCC change, maybe it's the GSE regulator who's going to change the nature of products. Maybe it's the OCC, the banking regulator, who's going to change the terms of how safety and soundness operate your business. Mm-hmm. All of those things are very important. And I'd say too few people in companies understand that and also the politics of Washington when it comes to new legislation such as Dodd-Frank. All of our businesses are heavily impacted by that. So having knowledge and insight, even at, you know, an inch or two deep, is better than kind of having your head in the sand and just running your business.
Oh, so true. So true. That's always interesting to get some insights into someone and why they went down the path that they did. And it's been a real value. And I think a lot of people, up-and-coming leaders, look at, you know, how did someone get there? Did they get appointed? Did they have to, you know, the key word is you raised your hand, and that took an act of your own will to step up to step into that opportunity. And so some people, that opportunity never been available to me. And I said, well, because maybe you did raise your hand like faith did. So one takeaway, those that are looking for how to get to where you want to be is raise your hand. That's a great one. Let's talk a little bit about some of this parts of leadership that you started picking up on. I want to start with how you define leadership.
Leadership is about being an active listener, but also thinking about the teams that you're building and finding something positive about each one of them. I think checking your ego at the door is an incredibly important thing to do, and making yourself a resource to the people that are working for you or with you, and making sure that you're transparent and you share your learnings. And I think all of those things build confidence. You lead by example. And maybe most importantly is if you figure out how to become an informal leader, informal influencer, I think it's the most powerful way to lead.
So is that when you mean an informal leader? It's like you step up to provide that. And where does the line of presumption come into? Because some people say, well, I don't want to look presumptuous. I don't want to look like I'm trying to run this thing. But that's a really good point. Right. That stepping into the informal, it's about going back to that comment, raising your hand.
When I first raised my hand to grow my career and become, first of all, becoming expert at something, whatever it is always one of the most important first steps. And early on in my career, the president was trading securities, Gene Merrill, Dominion, and I was the only one managing the reporting and pricing and securitization kind of back office work. And I had just been fresh out of school, and I was probably a bit naive, and that's okay for those of you listening, because I just said, gee, I think I should be trading the securities. You're the president of the company. You have way too many things to be working on. And he thought about it, and he nodded, and was charmed by my request. But really, within 6 months, I was trading all of the securities, and I was, attending conferences, and one of the few young women there. In fact, I remember very well a conference where I was the only woman at the whole conference. It was an options theory conference on trading. I guess my point is, you don't know what you don't know. Raise your hand. Your leader will give you feedback, but knows you're going to be on a path to doing more. Continue to be inquisitive. Continue to learn. Share your learnings with others, and it's amazing how much that is powerful to both your career but others who want to join you in your path toward forward.
I love that part of your story. First of all, I like the moxie, the willingness to step up and say, I should be doing that. There comes with a certain level of confidence in yourself, a belief in yourself in order to do that. And I think, is that something that's just comes naturally to you, or how did that self-confidence to say, I should be trading the company's securities? Come naturally, or was that a developed skill?
I had, parents with a great work ethic, and I worked a lot even through high school and college, and, I just always felt I was somewhat independent and able to take care of myself, and sometimes that's an important component of raising your hand. I decided I didn't want to be an accountant. I don't think I even told my parents. I just applied to graduate schools because I didn't want to be an accountant. I thought I better get more education. So I was an athlete. I think athletics helped. And I was a tomboy. I have a couple brothers and as many male friends as female friends. And I do think that has always been a helpful part of my personality, just getting along with all folks. So I'm not quite sure a bit of personality, but I believe a lot of people can do that.
That's good. I love that. Give us some examples of leaders that have inspired you. Going back to your earliest days in your career.
Sure. No, again, I feel so fortunate and blessed that I had strong leaders the earliest time of my career. So as I mentioned, Dominion Bank Shares, that was not only a very well-run company, but it was filled with leaders and managers that were top talent. People still reflect on that to me today who knew that team. Gene Merrill, that was we hired me right out of college, and I remember interviewing with him, and he was the president. And so, well, what do you need to make? And I just gave him a fairly reasonable but not a high salary. And he said, oh, I'm going to give you $5,000 more than that. You're hired. Come on Monday. So, you know, very confident, very hard charging, very smart, and willing to share the economics of the business model with a young person coming right out of school. So he took me under his wing early on. I reported to him.
Did he ever say, this is what I see in you, Faith? Did he ever tell you that?
He knew that I think at the time in the business, it had a mix of, you know, I think he just liked my background in education, accounting, and an MBA in finance. He was a CPA, I think, and by his training. But I think he liked my work ethic. My resume was filled with lots of work, and I was young, and I was ambitious, and just wanted to start working. It was my first real job, to be honest with you, right. Other than, you know, support
yeah.
jobs. Larry Hamilton came in and helped him run the organization, another top talent, top leader. He's a good friend to this day. And he taught me a lot about the economics and self-reporting and driving, you know, professionalism. He was also a CPA, I think, by training. And I really learned a lot from Larry. And then Jack Karaszewski joined the company, who is also a great friend to this day. And he led with a very different style. He was a charismatic leader, a caring leader. He wanted everyone to grow and develop. He sent me away for a week to go to Gold Dome, another old name in the business, to
yes.
learn how to buy loans from other companies and set up a program so Dominion could participate in the wholesale correspondent business. And he just sent me out to spend a week with a friend of his. And sure enough, it was 50% of all our production for the next several years. But that was Jack. So, you know, those three men, and there were some women, but they just weren't my bosses, but they were great
right.
leaders as well, were quite instrumental in my growth and engagement and curiosity of the mortgage business and my love for the business. So I give them my first nod toward leadership, I think. And certainly later in my career, I have some nice examples of when I ran the Hope Now Alliance of in you know, later years of my career that
right.
just have outstanding people.
So who are some people who have had a tremendous impact on you in your career and helped you as a leader? I
yeah.
love what you did at Hope Now, and I want to focus in on that because that's a great story
sure.
in and of itself. But
yeah.
you were at Freddie Mac. You were at some substantial companies. So,
you know, I love it, and to this day, I'm still a little bit of an entrepreneur. It's just in my blood, I think, because I, as much as I love the big corporations, I also like to grow and build and kind of lead efforts. So when I ran Hope Now, it was a very dark time, and things were just starting to implode.
Yeah.
Secretary of the Treasury reached out to the industry to really demand that the industry be responsive and step up and help fix the mess that we were in. Some of it because of the industry. I had a relationship with Steve Bartlett, the president of the Financial Services Roundtable, and John Dalton, the former secretary of the Navy, of the Housing Policy Council. And so they both called me over on a Thursday and asked if I could start on Monday, and I didn't have a salary. They told me I'd have to raise the money for my own salary. I'd have to set up the organization, but they felt... Now, who knew? They may have interviewed many people. They said I was the only one for this job. So, of course, that's a good leadership style.
That's,
I came in and
yes.
Not only jumped on board, I stayed for 5 years through the heart of the crisis. Gosh, John Dalton, all I can say is what a gracious, wonderful, humble man who's had a bigger resume and career than most anyone I've ever met in my whole life. I mean, he ran the Navy. He was the president
yeah.
of Ginnie Mae. He was at Goldman Sachs. He's very good friends with Jimmy Carter. He's very good friends with past presidents. In his office, he has a poster with five different postcards from living presidents wishing him a happy birthday. I mean, he's quite an inspiration and humble, and you wouldn't know it.
Yeah, I love the word humility, humble. I mean, because I think a lot of people think that to be a leader, you need to stand up and have this position of authority. And I love John Maxwell's
right.
five levels of leadership. But it's those that are the most humble. And also, have studied his life a bit, and I find him as just such an inspiration. And then one common denominator is the humility. Talk about him a little bit more, because I think that's something that, you know, because it obviously had a big impact in your life.
Oh, yes, John. He would help host a meeting, and I was calling meetings because I was the leader of Hope Now and that I was kind of appointed to that job. I would call meetings, and while John didn't set up the meetings, he didn't even tell me who to invite. I mean, it was my agenda. I mean, yet his presence at those meetings was very calming, and, you know, he knew how to charm the most irritated bank CEO or an angry angry congressman. And you know, John's presence and humility is contagious. He tells a funny story. And, I mean, he has stories that are just amazing that when he shares them, people are just, you can hear a pin drop. But, again, he just wouldn't know it. He has humble roots. He transferred into the Naval Academy. He didn't get in on his first try. And he ended up transferring in on a second try, went and found a congressman and sat and had breakfast with him and hunted him down and got a recommendation. And next thing you knew, he got to the Naval Academy, and he came from very humble roots in Louisiana. He's married to a wonderful woman, you know, Margaret, and just has a life of giving and friends, and he believes in his church. He's inspirational. He's great. And then Steve Bartlett is a little bit opposite.
I was going to say, he's an opposite-type personality.
Yes, but Steve I love, too, and I learned from both of them. Steve would keep me in the office till 7 o'clock on a Friday night, wanting to know what the numbers were of modifications, trying to understand who was being obstinate. Is Goldman Sachs giving you a hard time? Let's call them up. Let's get Secretary Paulson to do that. I mean, teasing a little bit, but he was the one who was very detail-oriented and a driver. He would say, I think you need to go on Squawk Box with Secretary Paulson and talk about what's going on to the public and to the listeners so the industry is responding. So he drove me to be a big public speaker, messenger about the crisis. And it was Steve that did that. So honestly, the two of them I look up a lot to, and they gave me just free rein to do what I did. But they were always there for me and had my back. Whether it was on the Hill, I did a lot of testimony at that time, or with bank CEOs who didn't want to report their numbers, or whatever it might be, whenever I needed them, they would step in. So they were really true leaders, without question.
I was thinking some of our listeners may not be familiar with Hope Now Alliance. If you could just give our listeners little insights into that.
Hope Now, for those listening, it was created in October of 2007 at the request, really, of President George Bush and Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, to get the industry to step up and deal with the millions of people who were defaulting or becoming delinquent on their mortgages. It was a complex issue because the industry and the status and the service of the industry wasn't up to snuff, meaning they weren't set up to deal with the millions of people calling their hotlines or their 800 numbers. There were no nonprofit counselors that they could work with because they only worked on the front end of the business. Loan servicing was an unknown business. Hope Now was pulling together the nonprofits, the government players, the bankers, the Wall Street players, the investors, to come together and agree and align on what methods could be done to reach borrowers, to modify loans, and to save them for foreclosure, and then report on those statistics to the public, to Congress, et cetera. It was like wrangling, of course, cats. But what was really interesting, David, is I've got to tell you, the industry pulled together. And as I said, I pulled together meetings with top echelon of the housing business. And again, you could hear pins drop. Secretary Paulson would come to these meetings, another key mentor of mine, someone I really admire. And the industry pulled together, and we did some remarkable things. We set up data metric reporting that of every month's delivery on what was done in the industry. And you know, the regulators came to me and Hope Now to get those data metrics and then set up their own to give oversight to their own banking institutions because we had pulled together such good information that no one had. So it was
What a time. What an amazing time.
I mean, it was hard, but it was great. And it really a real highlight in my career. And everything else is a little more interesting, but never will be quite what that was.
Well, it's such an interesting time, a traumatic time in our industry and in our economy and the world economy.
Yes.
And it really comes down to strong leaders who have to make tough choices. And certainly you ran with some leaders that were forced into making some horrific choices. Tell some of those stories. I think it'd be interesting.
Well, I think, I think companies went out of business right and left. I think people had to change their structure. They had to hire 1,000 people overnight. They had to, they just had to change the nature of how they were lending. Liquidity was non-existent. And so, the choices were vast, and people had to be public and transparent about what they were doing. So Wells Fargo, Bank of America, NationStar Mortgage, Mr. Cooper, all these companies had to report on their progress or not. You know, some of the banks were not set up to handle the distress, and there were some very tense meetings and moments around that. I mean, I was with the regulators, the days of Fannie and Freddie being taken over into conservatorship. We had to deal with the GSEs and FHFA on how to change their policies so that we could modify loans. And, they'd come to our meeting, so they were a member of the coalition as well. So it was, difficult. There were sometimes angry people at each other. But, people were, people pulled together. I give the industry a lot more credit than most do because I know what they went through, and I know how hard they tried to work for consumers to get that back straight. So
it was a mess, and it really takes leadership and people working together, which really gets to my next question. What are a few of the characteristics or traits that you believe every leader must possess, especially at these times of crisis? What were some of the things that you saw that really impressed you, as well as what frustrated you?
I think you have to have a moral compass, and you have to make hard decisions for the organization over your own sense of what's good for you. So confidence, humility, work ethic, moral compass, conviction, sense of humor, and grace. Willingness to be wrong. Check the ego at the door. It's easier to relate. Forget about the hierarchy. Enjoy relating to all the team and inspire them. Those are things I think about. And I think I was paid the highest compliment once when I left Hope Now. I stepped back from Hope Now after 5 years because I felt most of my work was done. But Steve Bartlett gave me a little talk to the group before I left in the last Housing Policy Council meeting, and he said, Faith is one of those people who speaks the same way to the Secretary of the Treasury or the server on your table. Everyone has the same treatment. She doesn't get
so
caught
good.
Up in the hierarchy. And I think that's a little something we should all learn more of.
It's such a good characteristic. It's one that's hallmarked to yourself. And really look at what the issues are. And you certainly saw some mistakes being made at that time. If you could talk about what you've witnessed as far as mistakes that leaders made, that you would say, if you're an aspiring leader, an aspiring influencer, avoid these things. You already talked about ego. That's a big one.
Yeah.
I agree that with that. But what are some other ones?
I think the business is a boom or bust business. So housing has been, difficult to manage through ups and downs, and you have to be a very astute leader and understand structural changes and kind of reordering of how the business is being done. And it's interesting. I have seen people who don't really have much discipline. They either lack financial acumen. They don't seem to have in place strong performance-based accountability. And they kind of lack foresight and decisive moves that can, devastate a company. Think about what's going on today. Just think about it. There are people that still are hiring loan officers, processors, closers. They have a distributed model of bricks and mortar, and they have wonderful brands. That's great, but that's very yesterday. And if you don't have a hybrid model, if you aren't thinking through the centralized, already executed and proven model of someone like a Quicken, and if you aren't thinking through how to compete in a digital age and transform that high-cost infrastructure of originating loans, you're not going to be able to do what you think you are, and your costs will only get higher because production that you once had is going to go elsewhere. I mean, I know that it sounds like 101, but there are people that aren't really accepting the changes and embracing them and adapting to them. I see that today, for sure.
There's so much that your story has to offer our industry, both going how to avoid the crisis, what brought the crisis about. I got to ask that question. I just want to insert that right in the middle of what we're talking about. How did, in your opinion, looking back over the housing crisis, yeah. I mean, it really started. I did a Fox podcast. I was invited to come in and studio with Governor Huckabee at the time, and he says, how did this all start? And I did my research on it, and I attributed it to a good intention. When Jimmy Carter came up with the basically avoiding redlining, it's basically getting financing distributed to areas which is needed, which is a good thing, but it just continued to morph and morph into something where you know, where home ownership became, it's the right of everybody rather than the privilege of everyone. But I'd love to get your perspective on it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think that's right. 69% home ownership was probably a little hodgy for who could afford it and access it.
Yeah.
And that was the height of the market. You know, easy money and house price appreciation, the asset bubble of housing, helped drive the easy way to originate loans that started to be originated outside of the agency boundaries and outside of the very tedious FHA or VA, you know, complex documented standards. And so what happened was that easy money and securitization allowed for alternatives and share decreases at both the GSEs and FHA and VA to become less meaningful and more powerfully executed at very similar low pricing, but with bad products, with heavy risk layering. Even I was working on standards while at Freddie Mac on understanding the market back in the early 2000s in a pilot. And the risk layering was one of the key issues we tried to curb on prepayment penalties. So that's part of the time I spent there was on that. But at the end of the day, you know, it was a perfect storm with easy global access and investment and mortgage-backed securities. So it's, you know, there is no one group that is responsible. Certainly consumers who were optimistic. Every consumer is optimistic, remember. Everyone who wants to buy a house can do it. So it's a real combination. I don't pin it on any one person, but I'd say investors, you know, they should have known more of what they were buying at some point, and that's where the money comes from. So.
Great perspective on it. Do you get concerned that we're heading back and we're going to see history repeat itself?
We are definitely not going to head back, not in housing at that level. It's illegal to make a loan that doesn't have documented or the ability to repay. Now, we'll have some, I think we're going to have a bump and, you know, we'll have a reset, but we're not going to have a global housing crisis because of this. No, I think they did a good job on some of the restraints that were put in place.
Yeah, it's good to hear. That's what I've thought, too. But I do get asked that question from time to time. And I think from your vantage point, you can answer that much better than anyone else. Let's talk about paying it forward. When you look at future leaders and the next generation, what words of wisdom would you pass along to them that you would say, these are areas you should focus on, you should think about, you should focus on? You've raised some good issues already, raising your hand, getting rid of ego, and surrounding yourself, if possible, with wisdom.
You know, you learn in your career, and David, I'm sure we all have learned in our careers, you the same. It's over time, you know, your peer group is a very important group. It's not just managing, say, what does my boss want of me and how can I please my boss? But everyone starts out probably thinking that way. So one thing that I've tried to think about what I've done consistently, no matter what role I've played, even in my consulting business today, I do it. Develop an expertise in something that's as good as anything you can find and share it. Share it with your peer, your teammate. At Freddie Mac, I developed a report about the market that ended up at the board of directors of Freddie Mac because it was a good report. So, I mean, you try to do reports that are meaningful, educational, and instructive. And to me, for a leader, for a boss of a leader, giving them that report on a weekly basis, it's very informative, and it helps them be knowledgeable as they walk into their CEO peer meetings and can present, here are the five things going on GSE reform, and by the way, with the new regulatory head at FHFA, here's what we believe is likely. Now, some of that is just reading and educating yourself, doing some research, meeting with the right people, But over time, you should develop some kind of expertise. Raise your hand, share it, be transparent. That's leadership. And
yes,
being prepared and preparing others. So I think that's a good one. And then, again, internal, external, I can't emphasize enough. I just spoke at a women's leadership conference, the NEXT conference.
Yes,
I was the
yes.
opening speaker on that. It was about women in leadership, but I believe it's, you know, again, I'm a little bit broader, that any leader should be thinking this way. And trying to network and make sure you're understanding what's happening in the world of technology, for instance, of public policy, for instance, how does it impact your business? What should you be doing differently? Is your vision aligned with the growth of the market or the shrinking market? And then, you know, sharing that or whatever it is you do best. I think those are strong leadership traits that will take people far if they figure that out and they add value and give it back.
Well, I think there's so much wisdom right in there. You also talked about reporting and metrics, and I want to dive a little bit deeper on that, because I really think providing information to your bosses and just giving it, whether they're asking for it or not, or if they're asking for it, giving it in at a level of detail, and talk about that, because I think that is something that's really missing in our industry, is understanding metrics. And the reporting of them, quite frankly.
Right. Well, so the world is changing as we know it anyway, and data and analytics and metrics are kind of the way that decisions are getting made anyway in the future. So having a strong handle on critical thinking and metrics is going to guide a lot of people. It's a digital world, right?
Right.
To me, any department, I don't care if they're qualitative or quantitative, should be driven, and you should be measurable. You've got to measure how many times do you call on a customer, how many times do you get results, why did you price the model the way you did, do you have a pricing model that can tell you what the differences are if you price every loan or you price one that's just closed, and then understand the revenue and the cost structure that you're developing. So whether you're an originator, whether you're in your loan servicing, I mean, look at how many people you have per loan and employees, your cost per unit, what's variable, what's fixed. Yes, I sound like an accountant, and I was trained as one. But if you don't have a simple handle on all of that, you are never going to be a great leader. You need to either hire someone who has a handle on that to teach you or and share that with you or do it yourself. And again, you can be in one department, three departments, you can be leading a team. But everyone should understand what success looks like. And it is measurable. And yes, even qualitative is measurable. I think that's very important. And I've always had metrics. It were reported on industry changes. So when I say develop a report, you could be in government relations. You could be in secondary marketing. You could be the escrow manager and understand how you've streamlined all the calls that come into your website, and because you've done a self-serve option on escrow and show the shifts of behavior of your customers. Collecting data, knowing how to use it and report on it is a very important part of any business, I think.
That's good. It's really pretty easy to do, especially with the tools we have today. And important. And I mean, and say, well, that data certainly must be collected by somebody. Well, even if it is, I would encourage you to take a look at it, because maybe you, the listener, are going to look at it just slightly different and have some optics that someone else is missing. It goes back to raising your hand and just being bold to speak up and saying, well, but are you looking at it this way? And if you do it with humility, people will receive it. If it's like, if you could just see the motive behind what people are doing. And if you do it with the right motive, be amazed what people will do. I want to get into the last question we leave with our listeners on, and that is, what are some of the resources that you would recommend someone look at or read to gain insights into becoming a better leader and a better influencer?
You know, David, I've given a little thought to that over the years. I get asked, and I've certainly been fortunate. I've been through a lot of corporate trainings with these big organizations, as well as, you know, smaller company trainings. But one thing I would just remind people is if you can find a mentor who's bright and knowledgeable and maybe outside of your company or inside your company, there's nothing better than that. someone has been kind of give you their deep experience and give you feedback on how you were in a meeting or not, or why you didn't raise your hand when you clearly knew more in the meeting than someone else, but you didn't think you would offer value. Those are really the most important learnings. I would say an old favorite of mine is Strength Finders.
I am
a true believer. People.
I love that.
Strength. And I have rarely had anyone work for me that I didn't work very hard to try to find out what it was that they were good at. They might have come to me with a mixed reputation or mixed results, and I always suspect it's because they weren't engaged at whatever role they had. And before you write off people, give them a chance to exhibit their strengths. Encourage them to lean into them, and then understand the strengths of the people they're with so that they can, I mean, again, I've learned this only over the years, probably stepping in potholes myself. And I feel like, you know, I've really become a real believer that, you know, let people do what they do best and let them fly. And almost everyone I've ever hired is way smarter than I am. Seriously.
That's what it should be. Yeah. It's amazing to see the number of people that do not hire people that are smarter and stronger. And it's like, well, I've got to be the smartest guy in the room. Well, your organization will fail because no matter how smart you are, you're going to fail. I think that's so true. I love Don Clifton's book, The Strength Finders. I think that is that one and the Berkman Assessment is some of my favorite tools that I love using in helping people. It's understanding your personality, understanding how you wire, how you communicate. That's just, I love the fact that you have suggested that. Some of the memories you have. I remember Kevin Ryan, you'd mentioned that in a previous conversation. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, Kevin was another one of those hard-charging, fun people, and I was probably the yin and the yang to Kevin because I could never be quite as much fun as Kevin, but I was the one who would look at the warehouse line contract and say, let's make sure this rate is the correct one, or, you know, I was a little bit the business execution side of that. Kevin was fun. We ended up, I was a limited partner with him, and we had a great quarter, and we said, hey, let's give everyone a $100 bill and thank them for their hard work. And it didn't matter if you were a vice president or the secretary or receptionist, and we called everyone together and handed them out. And that was just a proud day because that's what it's about. You know, engaging with your people, thanking them for their work, appreciating them, not differentiating the hierarchical side of things. And you know, another great leader I think you can read about is Hank Paulson from Treasury. You know, listen, it was tough what he did. The country was in dire straits, and he was a Republican. He didn't want to do the TARP bailout, but he knew that the banks needed confidence and capital, and interbank trading had stopped. I mean, it was very, very serious, and he did something you know he didn't want to do, and he begged for money from Congress and got it. It worked. It stabilized things. And, of course, most of it was returned and then some. So I watched him in action. I was at the table with him a lot during the crisis. I've got to tell you, one of the best leaders I've ever seen in my life. So I'm a big follower of Hank Paulson.
That's good to hear. It's good to hear because he certainly took his share of bullets during that time for some of the things that he did.
Definitely.
And
good
I think,
leaders, right? You've got to do what you have to do.
Yeah, and I think it's having a conviction, sticking with it. And look, I think he saved, as difficult a time as that was, he saved it from being a far worse crisis than what it could have been.
Oh,
we could have had.
And Chad was there with him. The two of them worked beautifully together. They really did.
Yeah, that's amazing. Oh, I could look at you said talk to you forever, and I can't wait to interview you on the Licking on Lending podcast because I really want to get into some things. But we're just going to deposit this last question in there for our listeners to tease them for your upcoming segment on Licking on Lending, and that is Mark Calabria. You know Mark. Any insights? We've now gotten to read the transcripts of his testimony in Congress. Go ahead. I'd love to get your thoughts at him.
Sure. Well, I know Mark like others know Mark in Washington. He's been a fixture in Washington a long time, and I respect him. He was on the Hill with Senator Shelby. He was over at the Cato Institute and Libertarian Group and housing and would write on policy, and, of course, is the Vice President Pence's chief economist. Mark is very, very savvy. He did a very good job on his hearing on the Hill, and as someone who knows the Hill well, that was to be expected. I think he's pragmatic, and he was very clear about where his views would stop and start, and he'll run the agency, and he expects Congress to do what they need to do as well. So I don't know when and if. I believe the nomination, the confirmation process will start after March, but until then, I don't know what his next steps are, but I certainly have known him a long time, and I respect him. You know, stay tuned on Mark and FHFA.
That'll be very interesting, yeah. Dave Stevens and Jim Parrott speak very complimentary about him. And while he has written some things that could be concerning to those of us in the industry, that this is some rough waters ahead or some major changes, and therefore anticipating rough waters, maybe we should just settle down and just wait. And for folks like you who know him and know him well, I think it's just like, no, don't overreact. This is actually going to be a good thing. So, I can't wait to have you on the podcast, The Lincoln and Lending, which is more talking about current events than that. But, Faith, I want to just say thank you so much for the leadership and the influence you have brought to our industry over the years. For those that want to connect with you, and also I encourage you, put in Faith Schwartz and LinkedIn, bring up your profile and friend you. You're active in a lot of things. And so we got to put in a quick plug for Form Free and some of the other things you're doing. Give us a quick overview of some of the things you're doing, and then we'll wrap this up.
Okay, well, Form Free is a great verification company. It's a fintech company, and I joined their board a year ago and have been the acting president, and we'll kind of streamline back into just to be an advisor to them over time because they're taking off and running, and I help them kind of get organized around that. They are doing income, asset, and employment verification, and then, you know, they want to transform the industry by offering even more of a digital DNA of the borrower right in the front of the lending process. They are probably integrated with more providers and providing more, you know, verification processes for Fannie, Freddie, and now FHA has just endorsed that type of product.
Yes.
So they're very much in the ecosystem. They're a great company. Brent Chandler was a great visionary who started it.
Yeah.
I'm on the board of Class Appraisal, and, you know, I stay pretty close to all the data and analytics issues. I'm on the board of Riskspan. I'm on the board of a civil rights organization, National Fair Housing Alliance. I work a little work for Mr. Cooper. So, you know, I'm a little bit still active in the industry and the vision of where it's going, and it's a very fun time for me in the business.
Oh, it's wonderful. We're so grateful for what you're doing, have done, and yet still doing, and it's somewhat behind
thank
the
you.
Scenes in a lot of this, but it's really a delight to have you and have you share
your
David. Perspective
thank
on
you
leadership.
Much.
It's a real honor. Can't wait to have you on the Lincoln and Lending podcast. I will do that soon. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, David. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Lincoln on Leadership, a weekly podcast about leaders in the mortgage industry. Tune in next week, and thanks for listening.